So, yeah, thanks for inviting me to come be a part of that. I'm part of this class on Christianity. As Reverend Rachel and I were talking, Rachel was telling me how she likes to incorporate some kind of experiential element with each tradition that you've studied. And she mentioned that a lot of folks who are a part of this group do come with at least some familiarity or some experience with Christianity. So we thought we would delve a little bit into a practice of the Christian tradition that is perhaps less familiar, at least in this day and time. Some folks might have some experience with it. And we posed the idea of looking at Gregorian chant as a spiritual practice. It had a lot more prominence many, many years ago, but it is still practiced. In fact, it's practiced locally. In Three Rivers, there is a Benedictine monastery that's connected to the Episcopal Church called St. Gregory's Abbey. It's a fantastic place. I'm connected to it as what's called an oblate novice. That's someone who's not a monk, but is part of the extended family of the monastery. And there are 7 monks who live there. And they're good friends of mine. And so I'll talk a little bit about Benedictine monasticism and Gregorian chant. If you would like to see it firsthand for yourself, that's a place within an hour's drive where you can go and experience it. I highly recommend it. I call St. Gregory's Abbey my happy place. I like to get out there frequently. So Gregorian chant. It is also sometimes referred to as plain song or plain chant. The history of it comes from the tradition of Benedictine monasticism. It is a particular style of chant. Different monastic orders and streams of Christian spirituality have different forms of chant, but this is the one that's gained dominance in the Benedictine monastic tradition. Benedictine monasticism got its start in the 6th century CE with a person named Benedict of Nursia, who wrote a guide for designing and running monastic communities that is referred to as the Rule of Saint Benedict. This is the most widely used monastic document in Western Christianity. When Rachel was talking about Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy, in the East, the dominant guide is called the Rule of Saint Basil, but in the West, it's Benedict. The name Gregorian chant comes from Gregory the First, also known as Pope Gregory the Great. He lived about a century after Benedict, and he did a lot to promote and establish the Benedictine monastic tradition as the go-to model for monasteries in Western Europe. And Gregorian chant bears his name, but he actually had nothing to do with it. On the one side, it's had been developing organically for quite some time and was being used in the monasteries, and it wasn't written down in a form of musical notation until many years, I think as much as a century after Gregory, but it still was known by his name. But recognizing the historicity of that, a lot of folks refer to it as plain song now in a more general term. Benedictine spirituality has a few emphases that I've listed here in your handout. There's a practice called Lectio Divina, which Rachel's told me you've done here a little bit. It's a way of connecting study and prayer on a particular text, most often in this tradition through scripture, although through other writings as well. And a whole course could be taught on Lectio Divina. Contemplative prayer, practicing sacred silence, what a lot of folks in our society would think of as meditation, in terms of just sitting in silence and perhaps having a mantra or sacred word, or sometimes just paying attention to the rhythm of one's breathing. There's a strong tradition of that. Stability, which is a unique feature of Benedictine spirituality, where monastic members of the community, monks and nuns, they commit to being a part of a particular monastic community for their entire life, and that is their home. That is where they will die. And so it's like a marriage, but it's not in the sense to a global order, but it just to one particular community. And it is, if you look in the rule of Saint Benedict, it's intentionally designed as a sustainable and as a self-sustaining community where all the necessities of life are there. There's a lot I could say about that. That went a long way to making Benedictine monasteries one of the only safe places to be during the so-called Dark Ages. When Western Europe was in shambles in a lot of ways, the monasteries, they had health care, they had security and safety, they had food, they had education, and they became places where folks knew they could go and be safe. And so monasteries thrived and grew and actually became rather wealthy during the medieval period in Western Europe. They're committed to hospitality, and it's a core discipline to welcome each visitor as if that person was Christ himself and afford that person the same dignity. But the center of their life is what they call the divine office, which is a daily cycle of prayer that happens every 3 hours. And these are the names of those services. If we have an analog clock there on the wall, we actually owe thanks to the monasteries for giving us this model of clock that we're familiar with. And if you've ever noticed that at 12, 6, 3, and 9, they kind of form the shape of a cross. That was intentionally designed that way. And those cross points, those four corners of the clock, I mean, it's a square, but if it had corners, those were the traditional hours of prayer. And clocks were used in Western Europe to help the monks know when it was time to go pray. And on all hours of the day and night, they would chant all 150 psalms each week and go through this whole cycle. And so there's a lot of repetition. The Plain Song expanded beyond the monasteries to become the standard form of liturgical music in the West, in the Roman Catholic churches, until the time of the Reformation. And it more recently had a renewal of popularity in the 90s when there was a series of CDs called Chant. And it was Benedictine monks singing just some of their stuff that they sing. And it became popular as sort of relaxation music in the 1990s. And those CDs sold very well, I'm told. And folks got interested in Gregorian chant there and realized, oh, how beautiful and peaceful it is. And it really is. Some of the features of the practice of Gregorian chant are it is done a cappella, which is, of course, without accompaniment of any kind. It's monophonic, which is a fancy way of saying there's no harmony. There's not basses or sopranos or anything in between. It's everyone singing the same note. It's unmetered, which means there's no rhythm. You know, and a lot of the singing we're used to doing, like in some of our hymns in church, you know, we have a very steady rhythm, and not just a line is rhythmed, but like the beats and the individual notes. And so, you know, one hymn that's probably more familiar to y'all would be though below me I feel no motion, standing on these mountains and plains. It rhymes, it's got a steady beat, and there is no beat in Gregorian chant. The only rhythm is the rhythm of your breath and the rhythm of speech. And so you sing a line at the rhythm of speech and take a slow breath and have that moment of silence there. And then the next line is sung, and it's always done very slowly with this rhythmic breathing. As we mentioned, since it is monophonic, the goal is blending. The goal is always to sing as one voice, for the community to be as one. And so it's done quietly, just kind of above a whisper. And the OSH stands for the Order of St. Helena. It's a group of Episcopal nuns in South Carolina. They like to tell their novices, God is not hard of hearing. and they say, you know, just above a whisper, sing loud enough so that you can be heard by your neighbor on either side of you. And together, the group makes the full sound. And again, that's a difference in the way we're used to singing, even church singing, where we're told to sing out, sing loud. And there are no soloists. That's not a performance. One of the unique things about Gregorian chant as well is, since there is no audience, it's not sung for the benefit of listeners in an audience. It's sung for the benefit of the singers. And if you were to visit, say, St. Gregory's Abbey in Three Rivers, the monks face each other as they sing. And what's happening is happening within this circle of singers, singing with and to each other. There is usually one voice called a cantor, and this is someone who sets the tone. It's a phrase we use a lot to set the tone of a meeting. The cantor literally sets the tone of the chant, the pitch, the volume. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the monks or nuns are called the choir, and they're usually divided into two groups, and they alternate verse by verse between right and left side. And they go through each of the Psalms, and in a week they go through the entire book of Psalms. If we were to look at a line of chant as it would be written in a monastic text, I've given an example here in this image. You can see that it does not use the modern staff, typically, that we see in our hymnals. It's a four-line staff, and rather than notes, they're called neumes. And you can see these illustrated here and what those look like. There's some fancier ones that aren't in there, but this is a simple tone. The pitch is always relative. So that, you know, we think of, you know, a B flat is always at the pitch of a B flat. But there it's based on the do re mi fa sol la ti do scale. And that little mark here that called the clef, it looks like a C up in the corner. That's where do is. And we go downward from there. So that would be the scale, would start up at the top there, and you go na da 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 na da 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 dum, and that same kind of scale that we would use, and the notes would flow around that. And it's relative pitch, because different communities are going to have different levels of pitch that they're comfortable singing at, and depending on whether it's a community of men or a community of women, they are gonna have a different comfort zone. And this system, while it takes a little bit of learning, it's a quick study. I learned it in a matter of days when I started studying this, so it's actually easier to learn than our modern notation system. For this line that we have here, what that would sound like, and you have one line up here, and then there's multiple endings for each tone. I'm going to use the one in the middle here, but what this would sound like is na da 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 ba, na da 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 da, da 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 da. So that's what would be written there musically for that. I already mentioned it's a relative pitch. The different parts of lines of chant is before and after each psalm, you'll have a refrain that's called an antiphon. This is usually a more freely composed piece, and the melody is kind of all over the place with those, but they are very beautiful, and they provide a nice refrain. Usually you'll have an intonation at the beginning. That's the first couple of notes, and that are most often sung just in the first verse. And so in the line I just sang, the ba-da, that would be the intonation. Next you have the reciting tone, which is most of the line, which for this one would have been the na. And that most of the words of the line of text will be sung to that. That's the reciting tone. Sometimes if it's a longer line, or if the line is split up, you'll have what's called a flex, which is a slight drop in pitch. So na da is what that would sound like. And you'll have what comes next is the mediant cadence, because each verse of a psalm is split into halves, and you get to the end of the first half, and then there's a median cadence, which in this case would be the part that goes ma da da da. That's the median cadence, and that's the indication that we've reached the end of the first half. And next comes the most important part, called the caesura. It's often marked by an asterisk, not always, but often. And that's a pause, and it's a pause practically to take a breath. But it's more than that. It is what they call sometimes the gateway to silence. That we reach the end of this line of text that we've sung, and we end with that median cadence. We take a breath, but it's intentionally a really full breath. So it's not just enough to get the air in. It's and then slowly go into the second half, which ends with what's called the, you return to the reciting tone and you end with the final cadence, which in this case, the reciting tone would go back to na, and the final cadence in this case is da 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 da, and that's what that would sound like with this tone we're looking at here. And so that real quick is just the different parts of a line of chant. So that's some of the practical components of this. The spirituality of chant here, the purpose that it serves is it's not just entertainment. It's not just getting through the day in a way that sounds pretty. As I mentioned, it is considered to be a gateway to silence. And that's why the caesura is so important. It's about, by following this rhythm of breathing and this intentional breathing and pausing, we're sort of deepening down into quieting our thoughts and emotions. Sometimes we're rushing in with stuff on our minds, and it's a way of quieting that internal noise that we have through the text and through the beautiful sounds of the music and through the pausing. This method of singing the text can be a great way of promoting reflection on the text that we're looking at, and they're usually texts of scripture, most often psalms, sometimes canticles, which are examples of biblical poetry other than psalms, also hymns as well that are often sung in that same way. It serves the purpose of building their community, that by intentionally trying to blend with one another, the members of the community are, they always have to listen to each other, and nobody's trying to showboat or do a solo, and so we're trying to match our voices with the people on either side of us, and together that makes us a community. And we start thinking and singing and praying as one, as opposed to the showboating to give a show for an audience. A beautiful way of thinking of that is that is meant to be in Benedictine monasticism, that way of singing is a reflection of that way of living in a way that blends all of our lives into a single song, and that our voices are one voice and we are a part of each other, and here in the silence and here in the singing, in the reflection of these words that as psalms they are prayers to God, but as scripture they are also God's words to humanity as it was understood. And so it's this conversation that's happening communally while the chanting is going on, and it can be very good for community building and for deepening one's own spiritual reflection. So really, to sum up what Gregorian chant is, I would say it is a form of sung group meditation in the Christian tradition. And when practiced regularly, it can lead to a lot of insights. I mentioned that, having been raised in a more conservative evangelical context, coming to a period of questioning all of that, but then returning to my own Christian tradition with a new set of eyes. For me, Gregorian chant was a big part of that, and my experience of being a part of that chanting at St. Gregory's Abbey, I felt something wake up in me, and I was able to engage once again with the tradition I was raised in from a new perspective, a deeper perspective, and a broader perspective. And chant for me has been a tool in that, and it's something I continue to make a part of my own daily and weekly spiritual practice. And I'm really happy that I get to share that with you today. So that's by way of introduction. So, would you like to try some?
Sure.
Okay. All right. So, I have here on the next page, and then flipping over to the following, this is sections of a psalm, Psalm 139. One that Rachel recommended might be especially good here. And what I have here is a very simplified tone. This is not one of the traditional Gregorian tones, but it's composed kind of in a similar spirit, and it's easy to learn. Yeah, so this is as simple as I could. We're only going to be dealing with three notes here. And the way this works out, let's see, do we want to try splitting the room up into halves or just going all at once? So,
are you all feeling confident?
Not so much. Okay, so then we'll go all at once. So we won't split it up, but then so you can just ignore then that some are plain and some are bold. We'll just ignore that. You'll notice that in each line, there's one word in italics. I hope it's readable with this font. In the first line is out, and then afar. What we'll do is, as we reach the end of that line, starting at the word that's in italics, that's where we'll start either the mediant or the final cadence. We won't do a flex here or an intonation. Keep it as simple as possible. And so the mediant cadence always comes immediately before the asterisk. That's the caesura. And the final cadence comes at the end of that verse. You'll notice that usually it's two verses, but some of them have three. What we'll do there is just stay on the reciting tone for that line, and we'll have a short pause just to get some air in at the end of that. But remember, it's an extended pause at the caesura. Why don't we try just for this first line there, first half verse, just to get the rhythm. Why don't we just read it together? And just try to get our voices as one reading. So if we'll go together, O God, you have searched me out and known me. Okay. All right. So one breath, we go through there. Great job. That's about the speed that we're going to go. And we'll be singing. And like I said, it's just three notes. And how this is going to sound for those who might not read music. To start, typically, what if we started on a pitch like, is that singable? And how it'll sound is, na da da da, na da da. Okay, and again, we'll go slowly. We'll sing loud enough to be heard by our neighbors on either side. God is not hard of hearing, and it will be repetitive, but that's part of the point, and it'll help kind of go in, and I think it'll help us at least get a feel for this here. So, so then why don't we dive right in, and if you really don't feel comfortable, feel free to listen, but if you want to be brave, it's a different experience singing rather than listening. So, and I'll lead us through. Oh God, you have searched me out and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You trace my journeys and my resting places, and are acquainted with all my ways. Indeed, there is not a word on my lips, but you, O God, know it altogether. You press upon me behind and before,
And lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is so high that I cannot attain to it. Where can I go then from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I climb up to heaven, you are there. If I make the grave my bed, you are there also. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand will lead me. And your right hand hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will cover me, and the light around me turn to night. Darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light to you are both alike. For you yourself created my inmost parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I will thank you because I am marvelously made. Your works are wonderful and I know it well. My body was not hidden from you. While I was being made in secret, and woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes beheld my limbs yet unfinished in the womb. All of them were written in your book. They were fashioned day by day, when as yet there was none of them. How deep I find your thoughts, O God. How great is the sum of them. If I were to count them, they would be more in number than the sand. To count them all, my lifespan would need to be like yours.
What was that experience like for you?
Oh, it wasn't as much fun as singing hymns.
So we won't be losing you to the monastery?
I think if we practiced that together a lot, it would be very moving to do it.
I found it to be that.
We're kind of nervous because we don't. Right?
Sure. Yeah, it's the first time.
We don't
time.
Have a lot of melody. We're parsing it along.
Yeah.
I think it's really important just to get the rising cadences and the falling cadences.
Yeah.
Yes.
That can be a bit tricky sometimes. Cool. And
I don't read music, but I love to listen to it.
I don't listen to it carefully enough. It's in the background too much.
Yeah.
So this slowed me down. Mm-hmm. So it had that.
Yeah.
I stopped paying attention to the meaning of the words.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I read something, I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
And that's only part of what you said this is.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of something very foreign to me as a very reformed Jew,
mm-hmm.
and that's the davening
mm-hmm.
of the Orthodox.
Right.
And what that must be, because the men do it all together as mm-hmm. they read from Scripture.
Yeah.
And I'm sure then, as you said, because mm-hmm. it's not the meaning alone, it's
right.
the community.
Yeah. Yeah, it's process as well as content.
Yeah.
And that process, by slowing us down, by doing it together, it's a different kind of attentiveness. And in fact, neurologically, it's the case. We're using different parts of our brain. If anyone has ever worked in elder care or loved or cared for someone in late-stage Alzheimer's or another neurological illness like that, it is sometimes the case that people can sing long after they can no longer speak. When I was a kid, I actually went to the same church as Dean Smith, who was the coach of the UNC Tar Heels. He was Michael Jordan's basketball coach. And toward the end of his life, he had Alzheimer's, and he could no longer speak. But if you went into his room and started singing the Tar Heel fight song, he could sing along with you. And he could still sing, but he couldn't speak anymore. Because it was a different part of his brain that was being used. And if you imagine doing this, you know, seven times a day, every day, going through the same psalms each day of the week, you become really familiar with it over a lifetime. And the content, in a sense, comes back to you in a different way, just out of repetition and familiarity, and it has led to a different approach to the text. Again, so very much not that fundamentalist approach that says every word's literally, historically, scientifically accurate, but instead it's how can this be a gateway to spiritual experience, and how can this be a gateway to understanding at a, what we might call, a meta-rational level. Yeah, so
even just listening to it on these CDs, you know, mm-hmm. and of course they always do them in these wonderfully reverberating chapels,
mm-hmm.
and so it's more of course it's usually in Latin, so you,
mm-hmm.
but it does give you this transcendent experience, certainly.
Yeah.
I've heard that the most common meter in English poetry, mm-hmm. the so-called iambic pentameter,
mm-hmm.
imitates the beat of the human heart.
Yes. Yes, it does. And actually, if you look, if we were to, I almost brought in one of the hymns mm-hmm. for us to try and sing, but all of the hymns are written, most of them are in long meter, which is 8 syllables per line, but all of them are in iambic pentameter for that same reason. So it's the rhythm of our breathing and also the rhythm of our hearts. That's, so we're engaging with this in a bodily way. So
I visited a monastery from time to time to buy things,
mm-hmm.
and the brothers they had taken a vow of silence.
Mm-hmm.
They only had one person who could speak to us.
Yes.
So.
Right. Would that have been a Trappist abbey? Yes. They're famous for that. And
they chant to each other? I guess that's my question.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The chanting is... that still goes on. The silence is practiced at other times of the day. The Trappists are the ones who emphasize that the most, although they don't actually take a total vow of silence forever. They tend to practice more silence than others. In all Benedictine monasteries, a very common practice is called the Great Silence, which is after Compline, which is the last service of the day, and before Matins, which they'll do at 3 or 4 in the morning typically. They intentionally practice silence between those times. And actually after Matins, at St. Gregory's Abbey, Matins is at 4, Lauds at 6, and Terce is sort of the third hour, and it's combined with Mass at 8:15. And so they practice silence from outside the liturgy, from the end of Compline, which is about 8:15 at night, until Mass in the morning. And they go, Mass starts at 8:15 and is usually done by about 9 o'clock. And so that's about 12 hours of your day that they intentionally spend in silence. Some of it they're sleeping, of course. But it's a lot of room for silence, you know, which, you know, we talked a lot about sort of the political environment we're in right now, both online and in the media. There's a lot of noise. And that cultivation of silence can be an important discipline for the development of empathy and the solidifying community. My experience of being a visitor at the monastery for extended periods of time is that I came to experience a different kind of intimacy with the people around me. And so other guests at the monastery, people who I often knew nothing about, but by just being near one another in the in the sleeping quarters, and we would attend the seven prayer offices, or sometimes we'd just be working in the library independently. But by occupying that same silent space together, there was a sense in which I saw that I got to know them, even though I knew little or in many cases nothing about them. But it's being human beings in the space, and silence, I found, can leave room for that. And I think it's a stark contrast to, say, social media, where we're hearing a lot about each other, and we become what I like to call these seething balls of opinions, and we're not ever engaging with the human being on the other end of that comment section. And this is the opposite of that. I'm not hearing any, like, this person in the room near me, they may be Democrat or Republican, they may have thoughts on things that I find inspiring or offensive. But we don't typically get into that. We're just sharing that space together. And I found that to be a really powerful experience of just human connection.
I always remember the introduction that one speaking person made to you.
Mm-hmm.
He'd say, "How are you?" And you'd, of course, say, "Fine." And he'd say, "You deserve it." Just never forgotten that. And he said it with great gusto.
Nice. I like that. I think Benedict would approve.
Song of Silence.
Uh-huh.
I had a momentary lovely experience just before I came here. I was in the D&W store on Parkview, and I didn't realize that the checkout lady was deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And so she just made a little sign, and I got it.
Yeah.
And then I spoke to her as she was watching me.
Yes.
And I'm sure I could have gone as fast as I wanted, but I wanted to engage her, so I spoke mm-hmm. more slowly, and happy holidays. Mm-hmm. We had a wonderful little 2 minutes or minute and a half.
Excellent. Well, you're practicing Benedictine hospitality. You're receiving this person, perhaps not in your mind as Christ specifically, but in the Hindu concept of namaste, the divine in me recognizes the divine in you. It's the sacredness of the other person that here with me is someone of ultimate significance, and we see this in each other. And I think in the communal part of Benedictine spirituality, that's the goal, both in chanting in this way and in practicing hospitality, whether it's a king who shows up at the monastery gate or it's a panhandler. Either way, this is a person of ultimate sacredness, and they should be treated with the same dignity that we would give to Jesus Christ if he were to walk into our monastery. And that's the goal. And again, something I think we could probably learn from in our society.
Now, do women practice the Benedictine? Do they also have
yes.
convent or nunneries
mm-hmm.
or whatever?
Yeah. There are many, different names for it depending on the community. There's incredible diversity in the Benedictine world because there is no unified Benedictine order. Every monastery is independent. And they all follow the rule of Saint Benedict. They have what's called the Benedictine Confederation, but that is sort of an advisory body. In the same way that the UUA as an association can advise and give recommendations, and it's generally, thought we hope that you abide by the seven principles and the sources. But still, the UUA isn't going to come and beat you over the head over stuff. In the same way, the Benedictine Confederation, it's an advisory body, but each monastery exists independently.
Are the monasteries thriving as a general thing or declining? One we visited was declining.
Yeah, that is very much declining. It's a good question. That's one of the, I'd say, the biggest anxieties in the Benedictine monastic world right now is the decline of people seeking to become monks and nuns. At the same time, though, one thing that's interesting is there's been an almost explosion of people seeking to become what are called oblates. I'm an oblate novice at St. Gregory's Abbey. And these are lay people who affiliate with the monastery and support its work and follow an adapted form of the rule, as folks in the world with spouses and children and jobs and stuff. It's been an exponential number of people seeking that, seeking oblation is what it's called. Meanwhile, the number of people seeking a monastic vocation to become a professed monk or nun, it's sharply dropped. That there was a big spike in the 50s and 60s, and since then it's been a pretty steep decline, and it's a source of anxiety. Monasticism has gone through periods like that throughout. I mean, Benedictine tradition's been around 1500 years, so it's gone through similar ups and downs before. But there are some. A really great Benedictine author, well, a couple I could name. One is Sister Joan Chittister. She's a nun in Erie, Pennsylvania. She's done a lot of fantastic writing on Benedictine spirituality. She communicates it in a way that is very progressive, inclusive, and speaks very well to the contemporary condition, I think. I love her writing. And find her really inspiring. I got to meet her once, which is very, very briefly, but it was really cool. Another one would be David Steindl Rast, another person. He's a Benedictine monk, and he has given TED Talks before that are available online. I'm a fan of those, if anyone else is. And he has written a lot of books, especially on the subjects of silence and gratitude. Are two themes that he explores, and he also is very intentional about exploring these from a multi-faith perspective, even though he himself is a Benedictine monk. And I think both of them come from the Roman Catholic stream of that, but they hold it in as inclusive and open a way. I think to the extent that they probably get a pass from some of the higher ups. These are Catholic authors that I think even a lot of Unitarians could glean something helpful from. So that is Gregorian chant.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for singing with me today.
Thank you.